argument is Miller versus Illinois Department of Transportation. Mr. Whitney.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. This is the acrophobia case under the ADA that's before you today. And I'd like, if I may, to jump right in and begin by addressing what I perceive to be the defendant's strongest argument. That is that the plaintiff was not disabled within the meaning of the ADA, and the defendant did not regard the plaintiff as being disabled. Curiously, the court below did not reach or address this question, even though we might regard it as kind of a threshold question. And I would suggest that the reason for that is that it was very clear in this case that the defendant regarded the plaintiff as being disabled. For one thing, it put him on non-occupational disability leave status.
Would this case have been more appropriate as a retaliation case under the FMLA? Is there any evidence that he was fired for taking a long leave after his panic attack?
Well, the leave was not exactly voluntary. In fact, he spent most of that time trying to get back to work. He presented evidence from two psychiatrists saying he was fit to resume the job as long as he had the exact...
What exactly is the job he's resuming? Is it on the bridge team?
It's a highway maintainer, which includes, but is not...
That's not my question. He was on the bridge team when he had his panic attack.
Yes.
Now, is what you're arguing is that his disability should somehow be accommodated by the bridge team, or what?
Yes.
Go back to the bridge team? Or how is his problem dealt with if he's back on the bridge team?
His problem is dealt with the same way it had been dealt with for 3.5 years. On the very rare occasions, in fact, it actually only happened once, that there was a particular task that he literally could not perform, they had four other crew members that could perform that task. He could be assigned to something else on those very rare occasions. That was the only accommodation that was required. He only needed it one time in 3.5 years. I know that
the other members of the bridge team.
I'm sorry?
The other members of the bridge team may not be enthusiastic about heights.
Well,
few people are.
I don't know that anyone's enthusiastic about heights, but some are.
It'd be pretty strange to be working on a team with four other people, and every time there's something like nobody wants to do, one person says, "Well, sorry, I'm disabled. You do it."
Well, there actually, the evidence in this case shows that there's all kinds of things that other members of the crew did not want to do, and they frequently did rotate. We introduced evidence there was
another. This wouldn't be rotation. This would be rotation among four people rather than five. Let me ask you a different question. When he was working on this, when he had to climb down from the bridge in order to change the light bulbs, did he have some kind of harness or some sort of safety line?
He did. There was a harness that you...
He wouldn't actually have fallen into the water, right? He's frightened. Yeah.
Right. It is a emotional or whatever mental response to that particular situation.
Well, the prospect of dangling as you hang from your lifeline over the Mississippi River is fairly frightening, even if you're safe. So
okay. Sure. Absolutely. But this was the one individual of that crew that actually suffered a panic attack, that actually had made an issue and informed his coworkers and his supervisor that this...
Mr. Whitney, let me ask you a question a little more broadly. This goes back to, I think, the point you were about to make with respect to other crew members or team members who had things that they weren't particularly good at doing so that others would cover for them.
We've
seen a number of cases in which employers have argued, well, we have a team concept, and in essence, to hold any job, you have to be able to do every job. Are you familiar with the kinds of things I'm talking about?
Employers
who take that approach.
Sure.
And I guess I have some trouble with how that fits under the ADA, given the definition of reasonable accommodation, which can require job restructuring and can require, according to the House committee report, the legislative history we have on the ADA, reasonable accommodation can require some adjustment of duties among different team members.
And that's exactly right. And I think this is the kind of case that illustrates exactly that. We're not talking about, the case that the court below relied on, the Peters case, where the very nature of the job as an operator and a laborer obviously included periodic lifting and required use of both arms, that a plaintiff in that case could only use his left arm part of the day or part of the time.
Why aren't you arguing that the accommodation would be to shift him to a team that doesn't work on with heights?
Actually, he did request that accommodation, and that was when...
What was their response?
And that was exactly when the personnel manager made the statement to him, I'll tell you right now, we don't grant requests, which was certainly, in my view, direct evidence of discriminatory intent when she made that statement. Incidentally, the same personnel manager, although the defendant has argued in this case there was only this one quote-unquote isolated incident, actually, fact 102 in the summary judgment papers indicates she made another statement when the plaintiff did not was applied a position with the crew leader rotation and signed up. His name didn't appear to list, and she told him, well, that was because of your accommodation request.
But what, going back to the first point, I don't see how acrophobia could fit the definition of a disability.
Well,
being able to cope with heights can't be one of the basic life activities. I mean, it would be if it was so acute that, you know, you'd be afraid ever to be in the second floor of a building. That would be a problem. But just being afraid of unshielded heights, that's extremely common, and people cope with that without any difficulty.
Well, the major life activity is, in this case, breathing that was impaired. As we argued,
that's not relevant.
But the larger point, and actually this
that
is the point.
That point is wrong. It's not just it's a small point. It's a wrong point. The point is you may have some terrible reaction to something that most people aren't bothered by. That doesn't mean that you're disabled. It depends what triggered the reaction. If the reaction was triggered by an allergy to peanuts or something, right, that doesn't mean that you're The reaction, if you have a peanut allergy, could be death. But that doesn't mean that that being allergic to peanuts makes you disabled within the meaning of the American
Which is why I
agree with that.
Yes, I would have to. But that's why, as I stated at the outset, I think our stronger argument is the defendant regarded him as disabled. And I call your attention to the memorandum, it was Exhibit 24 in the case, as well as 25, where their own memorandum states their belief that the plaintiff could not perform any task at a height greater than 20 feet, period. So the way they understood the disability, I believe they deliberately distorted it, but the way they understood the disability had a much broader scope than the actual disability. This means that, yeah, he wouldn't be able to work in any building that had more than a second floor. If you can't work anywhere literally over 20 feet, he wouldn't be able to drive over a bridge. He couldn't appear in this courtroom. I mean, there's any number of things, a broad range of employment.
You're not saying they believed that was his situation.
No, it was not in actuality, but that's what their own documents show. Therefore, the defendant did regard him as disabled.
What was the threat that Mr. Maurizio had made?
Oh, when he became, there was an occasion where he picked up a 2x4 and threatened to kill three of his coworkers, including the plaintiff. What happened, he had a deadly fear of snakes. He discovered a snake that was in a junction box. He believed that the coworkers had played a prank on him, even though they had not, and he went after him and said, I'm going to kill you, and threatened him directly with physical violence. Your Honor, I see that I'm into my rebuttal time.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Whitney. Mr. Boff?
Good morning. May it please the Court. Sunil Bawe on behalf of the Department of Transportation.
Could I just start you out? Because Mr. Miller's alleged threat doesn't seem, I mean, to me it seems pretty wishy-washy. In other words, he first states that he has never hit a woman, ever. And second, that he would like to knock her teeth out. Not that he planned on it. Not that he was going to. In the context of what we see, that's not much of a threat. In other employment contexts, we might caution a worker that a fair amount of a thick skin is required in these workplaces. Was there any evidence in the record about employees who had been fired for similar threats? And what about Mr. Maurizio with his 2x5 or 3x5 threatening, to kill these people?
Yeah, I don't think there was any evidence in the record that similar threats led to discharge. With the case of Mr. Maurizio, there's no evidence in the record to show that the department had any knowledge that that threat was made or that went up the chain of command.
Wait, you say something different in your brief, page 35. You say, there's no evidence that Maurizio threatened physical violence directly at a co-worker like Miller did. You shouldn't say like Miller did, you say as Miller did. What do you mean by directly?
Directly pointing to a specific employee, a supervisor in this case, Angela Ritter. And I think the only reasonable interpretation of that evidence
why is that important?
Well, I think it goes to the gravity of the threat that's made. Staring right at an employee and saying, I've never punched a lady before, but I'd like to knock her teeth out. That's not something that's...
As opposed to holding a 2x4 in the presence of the people you're threatening?
Right. Well, maybe I should back off a little bit on that. But there is also no evidence in the record to show that the department, the decision makers who have the authority to terminate an employee, knew about Mr. Maurizio's threat. Whereas here, there's clear evidence that the department had knowledge of the threat made not just to Ms. Ritter.
Was that argument made to the district court or to us before today to distinguish Maurizio's situation? Because I thought the district court simply ignored Maurizio's threat.
Right. It did.
It did.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
When you said he pointed at her, what have you, did she hear his threat?
Yes, she did. She was there in the room. It was in the District 9 office. And she was present in the room when he made that threat. But not just that. There's also evidence that Michael Barone testified the next day. He's an administrative manager for the department. That plaintiff threatened to shoot up the dongle
yard. Yeah, but that's disputed, right? And this is summary judgment.
That is disputed. But what is not disputed, though, is that the department, the decision makers to terminate Mr. Miller, reasonably believed that that threat was made. And in the Bodenstab versus County of Cook case, that's what this court held, where if an employing agency reasonably believes that the threats are made, not whether the threats were actually made, but if the decision makers reasonably believed that the threats were made, then that is a legitimate non-discriminatory reason.
Mr. Bave, is it correct that Mr. Miller was fired essentially on his first day back at work?
He was not fired on his first day back at work. What happened was he made a threat to Angel Ritter on the first day back at work.
Okay.
He was placed on administrative leave.
Immediately.
First day back at work.
So one of the things that concerned me is there's a pretty long delay between raising the ADA issues and the termination. But in essence, the first day back, we have the reference to Ritter, and then he's gone.
Correct, and I think that goes to the.
Would you agree that that at least applying the summary judgment standard, a reasonable trier of fact could infer that within this part of IDOT, there was hostility towards people who asked for accommodations under the ADA in light of the evidence that the plaintiff has offered about Ritter's comments?
I understand under summary judgment all reasonable inferences need to be taken in light most favorable to a plaintiff, but there is also evidence that the department had no positions which Mr. Miller was qualified to perform.
You're not answering my question. Would you agree that a reasonable trier of fact could infer hostility towards people asserting their rights under the ADA?
I think that that could be a reasonable inference, yes. Mm-hmm. But that statement made by Ms. Ritter that we don't grant accommodations, that was made way back here in July of 2006.
Did she change her mind?
Did she change her mind?
Mm-hmm. Did the policy change?
The policy didn't change. He had grieved. He had grieved being placed on non-occupational disability status, which, by the way, I don't think means the same thing as disability under the ADA. What had happened was the department brought him back as a highway maintainer again, not for a different position. There was no other position he was qualified that was vacant. When he was brought back, it was mere weeks after he was brought back and made the threats that he was terminated. I think the overwhelming evidence here shows that the reason for his termination were the threats. It was not one accommodation request that he had made almost a year before the threats were made. But going back to the fundamental issue on this...
It wasn't threats, was it? It was threat.
The department believed there were two threats that were made. Two threats. On May 2, the second day that he returned to work, Mr. Barone, administrative manager, he testified that Mr. Miller made a threat to shoot up the Dongle yard because he's had enough of all the rumors that he's heard. So the department believed there were two threats. And again, there's no evidence. It's undisputed that the department reasonably believed those two threats were made. But I just want to touch on the issue of disability. Mr. Miller is not disabled within the meaning of the act.
Yeah, no, we all agree on that.
Okay, well, then his disability is...
Maybe, but was he regarded by the department as disabled?
No, he wasn't. Because to be regarded as disabled, the department would have to believe or recognize that he has a substantial limitation in performing, and this is the critical term, major life activity.
Is it your theory that to be regarded as disabled, a plaintiff has to prove that, for example, a biased supervisor, somebody with a hostility towards the kinds of requirements the ADA imposes, has to actually go through the full analytic process and apply the statutory definition and reach a conclusion under it before somebody is regarded as disabled?
It does. The employing agency has to regard someone as being unable to perform, substantially limited in performing a major life activity. At best, the department believed that Mr. Miller had some trouble working at heights and he was diagnosed as acrophobic. But there's nothing in the record to show that the department believed he couldn't do a major life activity, which the EEOC regulations identify as being things such as walking.
And what about working?
Working a particular job duty is not a disability of a major life activity. Working, when considered to be a disability, is employment in general. The department never believed that Mr. Miller was unable to find gainful employment. There's no evidence.
Is that what you think the standard is? Any gainful employment, sort of like a Social Security standard?
That is the standard.
That's not even close to the standard. Well, the standard has to be tied in not only to the region, but also to the individual's training, history, experience, right, and the kinds of jobs he would have. For example, if I had a weightlifting restriction, that would not disable me.
Right.
If I had a history of being able to only work in heavy labor jobs, then that might be a disability for me. Okay?
Right.
So this has to be an individual analysis of this individual's history, his experience, his training. And I'm troubled by the evidence here that that the department, in essence, exaggerated the information that Mr. Miller provided. By saying he says he can't or he's unable to do any work over 25 feet. That's not what he was saying.
Right, and I think you're correct. That's not the purported disability. But I think what this goes back to is Mr. Miller made an accommodation request, and when he made the accommodation request, the way he wrote the accommodation request was he can't perform work when he's up on bridges. And, in fact, in his deposition, he couldn't really identify what caused his disability. The one thing he pointed to was working on a bridge beam. But he said there's other factors that cause, you know, my breathing to be affected when I'm up on bridges. But he couldn't identify what was going on. I think it was a fair assumption for the department then to conclude that he has trouble in general working 25 feet in the air.
Didn't he work in the snooper bucket?
He could work
in
the
snooper. Was that a problem?
He claims that at times it could have been a problem, but then at other times it wasn't a problem.
He was always able to do it. He was always able to do that work in the snooper bucket.
He had been able to do it, yeah, and I think that again goes to the fact that he wasn't disabled. I see that I'm out of my time. We do request affirmance.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Bava. Mr. Whitney?
Yes, thank you, Your Honors. Defendant persists in saying that the department believed these two threats.
Well, wait a second. I think the critical issue for you is there was Judge Hamilton was raising is what exactly is this conception of an erroneous belief by an employer that some condition is disabling?
What is my? I don't understand your question. I'm sorry.
How far does the what does the employer have to believe? What to?
Oh, yes.
For this to amount to regarded as disability.
I believe that if it's a broad range of employment tasks that the...
No, it's a much simpler question. If a... acrophobia is not disabling, but if the employer believes that acrophobia is disabling, then the act is triggered. Right. Okay.
Yes.
Now, what's the evidence that the employer believes that acrophobia is a disabling condition?
The defendant believed it was in his circumstance because it believed that he literally could not do any task over 20 feet in the air, period.
Isn't that what he had said, told them?
No, that is not what he had told them. He said that he cannot work at heights of 20 to 25 feet. If he is also in what he describes as an extreme position, and the only example he could say is, I can't walk a bridge beam. It's not that he couldn't, and there was a misstatement there, it's not that he couldn't work on a bridge, that he couldn't work on a bridge beam. That's the only example, and that's the only time it was in fact triggered to the point where he literally could not perform the task because he had a panic attack.
But do you think that the company thought that he is incapable because of his condition of working at any height? Is that what you think?
What
would be a straightforward case would be if he had said to them, I have acrophobia, and they had said, well, if you have acrophobia, it means you can't ever work on a bridge because a bridge is by definition, not on the ground level. That would be an example of a misunderstanding of acrophobia. That would be exaggerating its severity. That's what this employer believes a condition is disabling is aimed at. It's aimed at employers who by exaggerating conditions, disemploy people who are, in fact, employable. That's the object. Okay. So the critical question, I think, is did the employer exaggerate this condition, acrophobia?
It clearly did, as explained in the brief and as shown on exhibit.
Did you mention the term acrophobia?
I'm sorry?
did the company documents or testimony ever mention acrophobia as a condition?
I don't know that they specifically used the word in Exhibit 24.
What word did they? What is the condition they think he had?
That he could not work at heights over 20 feet, period. That's what Exhibit 24 indicates. And it's on that basis they said, well, we don't think he can work 75% of this job.
A misunderstanding of a condition or a misunderstanding of what he, or some other kind of discrimination? To say, they may have discriminated against. The question is, did they discriminate against him because they exaggerated a condition that he had brought to their attention?
Yes. They misunderstood, they misconstrued it, they broadened it considerably from what his actual description was of the limitation.
Did they misconstrue it willfully?
We would have to speculate. I believe that looking at the overall pattern of the case, that yes, that they did do it deliberately.
Your case doesn't depend on that conclusion, though, does it?
Not for this particular element.
That conclusion would invalidate your case. I mean, suppose someone said, I have a cold, and the company said, well, if you have a cold, That means you can't work. You're disabled. Your sniffles are preventing a major life activity, which is breathing without sniffling. That would be an example of... that would be discrimination. It would have nothing to do with disability, right?
But it would still
unless
be...
Unless the company sincerely entertained this ridiculous idea, that would be something the law tries to correct. But if it's merely a fraud, they're pretending that it's disabling, they don't believe it, then it seems to me has nothing to do with the Disabilities Act.
Well, the key phrase in the Disabilities Act is whether the employer regards the person. That's the word
right.
regards.
And in my example, no, he doesn't regard a cold as disabling. He says that in order to conceal what he's doing, which has nothing to do with disability.
That may be. In this case, there's no way of determining that. The memorandum certainly seems to be a serious memorandum in which they mistakenly regarded him as being disabled. Is it possible that they were harboring some other type of animus that motivated this? Sure, it's possible. But again, we're on summary judgment. I think that's a fact question that should have gone to the trier of fact.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Whitney.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Bava. We'll move on to